Hello and welcome to Philosophy with Will Anderson. I realise I'm just wearing my loud jacket now, so this is probably a terrible thing to be wearing for an intro to the podcast, but I just wanted to drop in at the top here and thank you for listening. There's been enormous numbers listening to the podcast recently, and thank you to everyone who's taken the time to rate the podcast. It really makes a difference just getting it out there. I mean, we don't have any money for publicity, although sometimes we get some free publicity through the press, but not always in our control, and it's particularly salient to today's episode, I guess, but we'll get to that in a minute. If you want to support the podcast at some stage, I think around the 100th episode, I might put together a Patreon, a specific Patreon for this podcast, and if people would like to support it and you feel like it has some value, it just helps me pay Podcast Mike, who produces it, and Mike Hell, our American editor, who edits all together and makes it all happen. So it doesn't exist without them. It's a fair amount of time out of my life anyway to actually do the podcasts. And, you know, they're fun to do. I feel very honored that I get to have, you know, these sort of conversations with people. And people are incredibly honest when they come and talk to me. I'm probably musing on that a little bit more than usual today because I recorded an episode today with Craig Coombs. That one will be out in a few weeks, but he's terminally ill, and he shared his story and his adventures with me today, and it just felt very... we were in a radio studio, which is not a very intimate situation, but the conversation was so intimate and so wonderful, but, you know, I'm tired. It's sometimes, anyway, whatever, I'm not going to complain. I'm just saying that it's nice to be able to pay people to help me out and make it happen, and without them it would not happen. And your support, whether it's just as simple as writing a review or leaving it a good rating on one whatever app, it gets it into the attention and it gets it out and about and people can share it around. And the more that happens, the more capacity I have to, you know, keep doing it and do more with it. So, around the 100th episode, I reckon we'll look at a Patreon page, but in the meantime, the other way you can support me, of course, is come and see me do live stand-up. I'm not doing much at the moment, but I am booked in at the Darwin Festival to do my show Will Eagle, which is, the show that most people have been, anyway, whatever. Don't bang on about that, Will. I'm talking to myself again now. Anyway, my show Will Eagle's on at the Darwin Festival. If you're in Darwin, come along. Ticket selling fast. It's on in about a month, and it's about 2/3 sold out already. So get a ticket to that if you want to come and see it. All right, today. M. Russiano's back. She did the podcast about a year ago, and anyway, it was a different time in her life, and I wanted to get her back on. She's about to go on this new tour. In fact, when we recorded this about a week ago, she was 2 days away from opening her brand new show, Rage and Rainbows, at Hamer Hall. Hamer Hall is 2,500 people. It's one of the most prestigious venues in Melbourne, if you're not from Melbourne. And Em was about to debut her brand new show, a show that you can't really rehearse in a 100-seat room and try out a few jokes on a Thursday night. And at the end of this conversation, we talk about, you know, the idea of whether she would be okay if I came along and saw it, because I haven't really had the opportunity to see Em do one of her full-length shows, her proper shows. But I know that I would be nervous about, you know, other performers coming along on opening night. But as you will hear, Em was generous enough to say that she would like me to come. And I'd just like to speak about the show just for a second, if I could, because it was amazing. I have thought about it a lot since, you know, which is a sign of a really good show. It was unlike anything else that's out there at the moment. It's unlike anything else that anybody else is doing. Em discusses a little bit in this podcast about the idea that she's never quite felt accepted by various communities. And when you see what she does on stage, it's part Lady Gaga, it's part Australian Idol, it's part John Farnham, it's part Barry Humphries at his greatest suburban satire. It's part RuPaul's Drag Race. There's giant dancing vulvas and there's brilliant songs, and it has a sense of... Her dad plays on stage with the 8-piece band that she has. And this is the sort of show it is, 8-piece band and 10 dancing vulvas, and she'll talk all about that. But, you know, the traditional 12 days of Christmas, 12 dancing vulvas. And it's a show that is about rage and rainbows. That's such a great name for the show because it is so an accurate description of what the show itself is. It's a force of nature. And I think sometimes there's a, you know, if you're a jack of all trades, then people consider you to be a master of none. And it's a theme that comes up in this podcast. The idea that, you know, M necessarily, like, has some feelings about not being accepted by the comedy community as being a pure comedian. And I think I can see why. It's because, you know, what she does doesn't neatly fit into what the traditional idea of stand-up is. But if Hannah Gadsby has taught us nothing, you know, but not just Hannah, Zoe Kumsma or Sam Simmons or Tom Walker or Demi Lardner, these people who have shown what you can do with the form and the format, and that there is no right or wrong answers to what a thing is. Well, here's what I will tell you. Here's what I know. I've seen all the best comedians in the world, and this show is, when it's being funny, is so fucking funny. Like, you know, laugh out loud, gut-punchingly funny. And it was the first night, you know, like, as a comedian, I know that that will only get better and tighter and more hilarious, but, you know, it landed hard and strong and fierce. The songs, there's like 6 original songs or something. There's a John Farnham medley, as Em will talk about in this podcast. But, you know, the songs she wrote with Kate Miller-Heidke, and it's like watching a 6-part Eurovision. Like, it's the thing that I kept coming back to was, I imagine in Madonna's head when she wanted to try stand up, this is what the show would have looked like. When Madonna had that dream that night that she goes, I could use all the skills I have as Madonna, but also be hilarious and do a show like that. She had a dream about M. Rusciano's show. And then she tried stand-up. It did not work out for her, but it does work out for Em. It was fantastic. The other thing that I noticed was that it's for an audience that isn't being catered to by other things. Of the 2,500 people at Hamer Hall, I'd say that 2,200 of them, I'm guessing. I don't even know why I corrected myself. But let's just say over 2,000 of them are women. I've never been in a room, I think, you know, that disproportionately, you know, one way or the other, you know. So it was a lot of women, a lot of mothers, a lot of people who understand, you know, who are laughing and crying at stories of babies or pelvic floors or, you know, sneezing and these things. So it is definitely for them, and they love her. You know, they dress up, they come out, they support her. It's as much a show as it is a celebration of all of them. You know, she has that sense of being still that little girl who went and dressed in her mum's clothes and put on a show for her dad, and her dad is still sitting there on stage playing in the band now. And there's still that sense of, like, you know, yeah, I've got some costumes. You know, it's a rainy day. Watch my 6-part show that I have put on, but just done in, you know, to the nth degree, you know, to this spectacular celebration that the audience absolutely loves. There is probably a couple of hundred gay guys, and then there's the 100 or so straight men who Em asked to stand up during the show, fair warning. I decided to equivocate about my sexuality for the sake of not having to stand up. But I, here's what I would say about that. And the only reason I rate that observation is that I think that is a shame, because even though the jokes in the show and the story of this show and the idea of the, you know, the expressions of the things that make women angry and what they're angry about and where that rage comes from and what it means, they're things that men should hear. I did not feel alienated from the show. I loved the show. Of course I can laugh at a pelvic floor joke, and And there was this great sense also, men, of me just going, oh, okay, this is what they're laughing at behind our backs. And I think at the very least, it would be incredibly educational. Come along, come on a secret mission, put on a disguise and see what your wives are laughing at behind your back. It was a wonderful show. It should be for everybody. It takes nothing away from it, from the fact that you can sell out two Hamer Halls based on just being the favorite person of that demographic. But, you know, if everybody else gets on board, it should sell out five Hamer Halls. I loved it. I love this opportunity to sit down with them. I don't want to linger about, you know, what happened last time because that's in the past. I wanted to talk to Emma about where she's at now. I think that's, you know, that's as interesting as anything else. I had no particular interest in going back and going over what happened a year ago and what happened post that podcast, which I loved, by the way, because, you know, I love M at full flight, but this is a different M today. Still with all that in her, you know, the greatest expressions of who she is. But for somebody who was 2 days away from opening a really wonderful show and a massive production and, you know, 6 months after having a baby, if I had a hat on, I would dip it to her. So glad to have her back on the podcast. I hope you enjoy this conversation that we had. If you've never heard the original one, you know, maybe listen to this one now and then go back and dip into that one. But thanks for spreading the word. Thanks to Em for doing this podcast. Go and check her out. Oh, that's what I should tell you. Hobart, Perth, Brisbane, Sydney. There may be still some tickets available. And I reckon you'll have a really good time if you go out and see the show. All right, here it is. Em Rusciano. Oh, hello and welcome to Philosophy with Will Anderson. My name is Will Anderson from the title of the podcast. Comfortable is the theme for today. Comfortable amongst discomfort is the theme for today. I am rearranging my microphone because Ramona, my dog, is sitting on my lap and she's licking my hand and she's decided to sit essentially where I had the microphone placed previously. She was, before that, Winnie's at the feet of my guest here today, and it's a cold Melbourne winter's day. We've got warm cups of coffee and we've made ourselves comfortable. We've invited the dogs into the podcast today, so at different stages I imagine that they're going to pop up and interrupt or need to be loved in the middle of it. But I think it's good. I think it's a good environment. It feels cozy. And it feels like it's the right energy for what's about to happen here today, because I have a return guest, and I do return guests on this podcast. It's you're certainly not the first one. I had the great honor of Dan Sultan, recording a podcast with me a week before that. He had incident in regard to his relationship with alcohol and a bunch of things, and he came back and did an entire episode, you know, 9 months down the track, all about that. And, oh, hang on. Now, Winnie's decided to go downstairs and bark it. That'll just be her trying to be a guard dog. Anyway, look, I should introduce our guest and then we can talk. So anyway, this is how the podcast starts. I ask the guests who they are. Who are you?
Em Rusciano.
Oh, my God. She's back. Hello.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm much better than the last time we sat in this room.
I know.
I mean, I've seen you since.
Well, I think this room is better too. This room has improved as well.
It's more lived in.
Yes.
So there was not much furniture actually the last time I was here.
Pretty sparse. I was just moving in at the time.
I was worried for you.
Now there's piles of useless shit all over
the
place.
No, you're very intellectual. I like, look at all these piles of books. Straight away, I'm intimidated. I love what you've done here. You're trying to, like, you lull people in. Look at my cozy couch, but look how smart I am. I have a 6-foot-high tower of books.
Did you notice, though? Because there's another tower coming in the next couple of days, because I underestimated how many towers I'd need. I bought one tower, and once I put the books on the tower, I realized I had
more towers.
I need another tower. Yeah, wow. So there's another tower coming this week.
Good.
I have arranged the books in
color. Of course. I study visual merchandising. I understand color blocking very well. I've done the same thing at my house.
Is that right?
Yeah, I feel like we have a lot of similarities. I always think you're a kindred spirit. I always say that about you. Yeah, but that's, I would do that. I do that with my cupboard though too.
Winnie.
I like the barking. It adds to the coziness.
No, she can, but she can come up here and sit on
Winnie,
the bed.
Go to bed.
Go to bed. I brought your bed up here so you could sit on it.
Yeah, I kind of alluded to the fact I was coming back and a lot of people were excited.
Well, I mean, your episode that you did last time, like, is one of, you know, I think the most talked about episodes in the history of this podcast.
Well, and I mentioned it again on another podcast a couple of weeks ago, and then I went straight back into the top 10 after just mentioning it.
Yeah.
People wanted to hear why I intentionally drove my career into a wall.
So that was last time.
Not much has changed, really. I mean, God, what's new with you?
So how long ago was that we talked?
I think that was a year.
Yeah. Okay.
I feel like it's almost a year to the day.
Yeah, it wouldn't be far away from that, probably.
We were close to mid-year holidays and I was spent.
Yeah.
And I listened back to it and I think I said this to you. I realized I was trying to self-sabotage because I listened back to it in a much better headspace and was like, I had to pause it a couple of times. And I was like, holy fuck, what did you just say? What the hell did you? But I remember leaving thinking, God, that was great.
Hmm.
You know, Will and I had a really good chat.
Cathartic.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, but it probably.
It was good. No, it's
at
what
the
I
time
needed.
It is what I needed.
It's
what you needed.
At the right time, you came in and asked the right questions. It just, now I'm out and clear and I'm glad that happened because my husband had to take me away for the weekend because I was so distraught. And that's the weekend Elio was conceived. So I wouldn't have this beautiful six-month-old child really without your contribution.
Well, that's a nice way of putting it. I appreciate that.
Really, I should have called him William.
I mean,
really.
It's a very traditional but lovely name. So what I wanted to do, and I was so glad when you said that you would do the podcast again because I just thought it would be nice to catch up with you now.
Yes.
And see where you're at. Like, I have no particular interest in going over what's gone past, but I am very interested in knowing what you're up to now. And it occurred to me because you were, doing a new tour. I was like, well, Em and I are on the same page with this, which is like we both see the opportunity of flogging some tickets. So I was like, oh, well, this might be a good opportunity to ask if Em would like to come and do the podcast again. So I want to see where you're at now. So you're what? At this stage, the stage of us recording this, people hear it a few days afterwards. But when we're recording this, it's a Wednesday. So it's a week before this will be out, basically.
Yes.
And on Friday, you debut your brand new show.
Yes.
So it's called
Rage and Rainbows.
Rage and Rainbows. Mm-hmm. And I saw you straddling a unicorn as part of the so Rage and Rainbows. Tell us about where you're at 3 days before, launching this huge new tour. Tell me about what your life's like at the moment.
I swing between enormous excitement and then just debilitating anxiety and dread. So it's just this, there's no middle ground at the moment, which is exhausting. And I especially wanted to come and see you because I know it's a unique thing going into a national tour, a big one where you've been working on the material and it's been a year in the making and not many people understand the emotions and you do. So my husband said, it's good you're seeing Will because he'll be able to just listen and understand. I said, yeah, I'm excited. I've been at home with a baby and I've kind of sequestered myself and had to finish the show. I'm also writing a book at the moment, my first fiction book. So I've had a lot of writing to do. So it kind of feels like I'm walking back out into the world and it's going to be quite overwhelming. But I'm really excited. It's the best thing I've ever written. It's the most freed I've ever been. It came from a really dark place and ended up in a place of joy. So the Rage and Rainbow title is kind of explained in that way.
Where do you start writing a show like that? Where does it start in the first place? Do you start with a kind of idea of what it will be and then let it kind of become what it is? Mm-hmm. Or do you start with no idea about what it's going to be? Is it completely different to what you thought it was going to be?
Yeah.
Like where did that process start? When did you put on the vision board? And I don't mean literally the vision board, but as a performer, there's a kind of structural vision board, which is that if you're going to book the venues that you play, if you're these things aren't available on a week and a half notice.
Mm-mm.
You know, you're going to have to say, this is what I'm going to do in, you know, June next year. This
yeah,
is
you
what
know,
I'm
we think of the
in...
title for our shows before we've even written the shows.
Exactly.
You know it. We shoot the poster. We don't even know what the fucking show's about.
Here's a bit of a tip. Just put your name in it. Make it a pun. Very easy to just roll those out.
I love that. I love that.
So tell me about the process of how you got to, you know, 3 days out from, you know, going on a national tour.
I was crossing the road 6 months pregnant last year and I just kind of left the radio and a truck driver yelled out the window to me, "Why don't you smile, love?" And I turned around, I snapped and I turned around and said, "Why don't you break your own arm off and fist yourself up the ass, you fucking mongrel?" And I was... yeah, I realised in that moment I had a bit of shit to work on.
I mean, it's poetic.
Totally.
Though.
And like, look, he makes an appearance in the show and I was with my 17-year-old daughter and she said to me, like I was bent over heaving in the middle of up at Clifton Hill on near Shots on, I don't know, on Punt Road. And I was bent over heaving and pregnant and my 17-year-old daughter said to me, "Are you okay?" And I looked at her and I said, "I'm fine." But I wasn't fine. And I've been saying I was fine for so long. And so I started asking the women around me, you know, how they were twice. You get the first one, I'm fine. But I like to dig. I want to know. So I'll go, "No, how are you?" And they all started saying, "I'm really pissed off and I don't know why." So I started doing a deep dive on female rage and that's where the show came from.
So where does that, firstly, very poetic way of being rageful though. Mm-hmm. I mean, was it cut your own arm off or tear your own arm off?
Cut your own arm off. I believe it was cut your own arm off and fist yourself to death. Shut up your ass.
I mean,
and fist yourself to you fucking mongrel.
Just so much work in that
but
as well
know,
because like,
yeah.
Firstly, you've got to cut the arm off.
I thought about all the steps.
Yeah. But then secondly, once the arm's cut off, to then use your other arm with your arm to
correct.
Be able to fist yourself.
And using the word fist anyway.
In a vigorous manner.
Correct.
I mean, to death.
Till you die.
Until you die. Well,
till you drop this bloody stump on the ground and drop dead.
I mean, technically, you were probably dropping dead because of the blood loss from
the arm
cut
being
off
cut off.
More than the fisting to death.
Semantics.
What gets you first?
I wanted to, what's going to get him first? Extreme blood loss or extreme fisting? I want you to know that I did curb myself because I was in front of my daughter and I said mongrel and not cunt.
Okay.
So I wasn't completely off my head.
She was fine with the fisting yourself to death bit as long as you said mongrel.
Don't say cunt.
So when you say, firstly you have to start then with going, I'm mad.
I'm so mad. And I was in a place where I felt like I was out of control of my life. I was out of control of what the media were writing about me. I was out of control of my career. I was out of control of my body because I had a baby growing in it. And I was desperately trying to not be rage-filled because I was concerned about losing another baby.
Yeah.
Because my stress was so through the roof. You know, after all that happened last year, all the most awful things I'd ever thought about myself in my worst moments got written. And, you know, it was just this whole terrible, terrible thing. And then I realized lots of things were making me angry. And I went to therapy and I wrote it all down. And I had to roll right to the edge and to the end of, okay, well, why is one person writing one mean thing about you, throwing you for a week? And why do you want to track that person down on Facebook, get them fired, find their mother, screenshot what they've written, send it to their mother and get them so fucking angry and in trouble so that they feel as bad as you do? So I had to go through all of that. And I realized that all the things people were writing about me, I was worried were true.
Right.
That's what it comes down to. And
somebody said it to me. It's easy to hear, but it's harder to put into your life.
Absolutely.
But somebody said to me once that criticism only hurts if you believe that it's true.
It's absolutely right.
Otherwise, who cares what somebody else says? If you think that somebody, it's like if, you know, like the idea of at some stage it would have been in my life if someone goes, "You're not funny," I would have been hurt by that because I would have been, but these days I'm just like, mate, well, clearly some people think I'm funny.
Look at my posters on the wall. Look, mate, he's got a framed poster, mate. People who aren't funny don't
get
framed posters.
But the point is, absolutely, you know, there's heaps of people who don't find me funny. I'm very comfortable with that.
I doubt that.
But the idea that you're not, you're like, it's okay, I've...
Yeah, there's some things I'm rock steady on.
Now I can walk away from that sort of comment because I don't believe it's true.
No.
But if you... if they're saying something about you that you have some sort of doubt, oh, yes, now she's doing her.
Here we go.
Winnie has a way of going, she wants a bit of love, where she will do the little paw thing
she's
and
very subtle.
Demand a little. Just say,
she's
hey.
Like, excuse me.
Hey, can I have some of this?
Excuse me. Can you move your hand?
Can I please have some of this?
You're so right. Because if someone says to me, you're a bad mother, I'm like, whatever. Yeah. I'm a fucking awesome mother. My kids are model citizens. They're great. I love my kids. But if someone says to me, oh, you're a diva or... no one wants to work with you or you're not funny. I'm still self-conscious about my ability to be funny. I haven't got where you are. Then I do stew on it and get angry and get upset. So all the things that were being said were like, oh, God. But
so – and I don't want to delve too much into
look,
this.
We can delve a bit because people want to hear.
Yeah, well, okay. Well, I'll delve as much as you feel comfortable.
Yeah, sure.
But I'll ask you this.
Yeah.
Because not many people – go through that.
No.
Not many people go through the idea of becoming somebody that the media have decided is a person of interest, you know, like, you know, as in like, you know, in this clickbait world that we live in.
And I am for some reason.
You drive clicks, right? And they can write a story and, you know, people suddenly there is this idea of you out there in the world that weirdly enough, the more they write it, the more you almost become it.
Self-fulfilling prophecy.
Right. Mm. Tell me kind of what is that like to have an external opinion of you start to shape what you're actually like?
Well, you're right. And it's exhausting. And it was starting to happen. And I've just now been able to turn that buggy around. Even my followers, thank goodness, are, like I've got this huge community.
The best. Seriously. Like, I mean, one of the great, and this is, you know, I mean, one of the great gifts I got from that podcast was the amount of your followers who, you know, very much are, you know, the way that they have your back.
Yeah.
And the way that they are there for you.
Yeah.
You know, and the way that they are inspired by you. And even in that podcast, we're so proud of the way that you spoke the truth of the moment that you were going through.
Mm.
And that's exactly why they follow you and why they adore you, because when you are going through that, you know, you bleed for them.
Yeah.
But they didn't want you to have to keep bleeding.
They
were like, we love this about you that you will, you know, kind of, you know, you'll do it for us and you'll show us how you're hurting and you wear it on your sleeve. But also at the same time, you could see how protective they were of you of going, we don't want you to be feeling like this all the time.
No. But they've gone to the trouble of getting to know me. And they've gone to the trouble of coming to see me do stand-up. And so their opinions are valuable to me because they've seen the whole 360 vision of me, whereas there are other comedians, other performers, journalists who have never seen me do what I do best, and they make judgment calls on opinions of other people or maybe snippets they've heard of me on air. But, I mean, like last week I did The Project and it was a great interview and, it was, you know, it's kind of – everyone's watching it. It was great. And then news.com – decided to make the headline or M and Waleed's incredibly awkward interview. And it was like, no, but it wasn't. But I read it, just laughed. Whereas 6 months ago, I would have been in a fury over that because I now trust the people that I care about to know the truth. Whereas a while back, I was so panicked to be able to get every set of eyeballs that read those horrible things about me and grab them by the shirt and say, no, you're wrong. That's not true. So I'm at peace with it now, and I don't know why I'm so interesting. I feel like I put everything out myself on my own channels. I don't know what anyone else could learn more from.
I believe that's part of the fear. I do, because I've experienced some of it myself.
Mm.
You know, I don't pretend to have the window into it that you have, but you know, I have had glimpses through that window, and I think part of it is that old media is terrified of people who have their own audiences.
Mm.
Like, you know, they used to be the gatekeepers.
Yeah.
They used to be the people who got to tell the public, you like this person and you don't like this person.
Mm.
And this person, you know, plays by the rules and this person doesn't play by the rules and we set the agenda.
Mm.
And they have seen the power of their capacity to influence people's opinions on those things. Mm. You know, through the amplification of, you know, fake news and the clickbait nature of the media and, you know, the dying nature of the media. It's not all their fault, but it's been a response to that, which is the headlines get more and more extreme and the opinions have to get more and more extreme to get people to...
Stop putting names on the things they write about me. Yeah. It's always a staff writer because my community just find those journalists and just go them.
And they're terrified because you have your own community.
Yeah, and I'm so grateful, Will.
They're terrified because you don't need them.
No, look, I'm just grateful that I have found these people and how supportive they are, and it's a huge responsibility to me, and I know that I have their eyes, and, you know, so people always want to buy their eyes off me. You know, the term, if I ever get called an influencer, I'll be very upset.
But you are in the actual proper meaning of that.
I don't know.
Is that you are a person who people admire, you know, the way that you live your life and the art that you make and the communication that you put out there.
Mm.
That's how you've built that fan base. Mm. You've built it through... You know, you haven't built it through, you know, bikini shots on Instagram. As far as I follow you on Instagram,
No one needs that in their life.
Again, and by
the
way,
there's not enough filters, mate.
And the other thing is also, if people build it that way, I'm fine with that as well.
Me too. You live and let live. I'm the same.
I'm not. Yeah.
Whatever.
I realized that sounded a bit too judgy. I didn't mean it to sound judgy, but. I'd like to apologize to the large legion of bikini clad Instagram influencers who listen to this.
Definitely.
Podcast, my major demographic. Please do a Willosophy plug in Eunice Bikini Shop.
When you look out at your audience, it's just women in bikinis.
I mean,
on brand.
All right. So you went through that.
Yeah.
You're pregnant.
It was just incredible. Everything was.
And so tell me.
I didn't think I'd survive it.
And again, I hesitate to ask about all these things because I don't want to create, you know, more trouble for you.
It's
though.
Fine. Just ask, but and I will be very cautious.
You went through, you know, a publicly horrible experience losing a child.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then suddenly you're pregnant again, mm-hmm. as you say. Mm-hmm. You know, you're 3 months in and you're filled with rage.
Mm.
And I imagine pretty terrified about, I'm guessing.
Well, I didn't realize.
Like, are you scared that the same? Like, you mentioned that you start to worry that you know.
Yeah. So, you know, losing the baby, all the things that I had been smiling and waving at, and being really brave about, and being openly, I'm hurting, but I'm moving on. I hadn't moved on.
Yeah.
I'd put a Band-Aid on all of those things.
Do you find that anger is, well, from my perspective, I'll say this, that I find in the moments where I become angry, that is so often a bunch of things that I have been putting Band-Aids on.
Correct.
That finally become just too much. It's never the one thing, you know, sometimes, yes, I'm angry about the thing, but I'm not really angry at the thing.
No, you know, like, poor fucking guy.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, that was the tipping point for me. You're so right.
Sorry, mate, this is not all about you. I have requested you fist yourself to death, but I will confess, this is not all about you.
I should have called the show Fist Yourself to Death.
Yeah, I mean, I can't stop saying it.
If you take anything away from this podcast.
I mean, it'd be great to see the James Fosdyke picture of you just with the quote, fist yourself to death.
Please don't put that on my little picture. Oh, Jesus Christ. It's going to happen, isn't it? Shit, I should have sold it as merch. Just a fist.
Oh, I mean, yes. Really, so, all right. So you decide you're going to write a show about female rape.
And from little girls, we're taught that it's important to be liked, and we teach little boys it's important to be respected. And so we grow up as women wanting to mold and shape ourselves into pleasing machines, into making everything okay. And little boys and dudes don't feel that pressure. They don't grow up like that. They grow up with different pressures, obviously. So, yeah, anger, people are comfortable with women being sad, but anger's great in that it's a doing emotion. But for me, I got really stuck in that rage, and it started to manifest in, I was eating it. And I think a lot of women do this. They eat their rage, they drink it, they online shop it. You know, they swallow it down and it bursts out in other ways and in other health problems rather than just...
What do you eat when you eat your rage, by the way? I'm just curious because, I mean, for me, that's...
What do you eat?
Well, I mean, because I'm vegetarian.
Yeah.
So...
Yeah, how do you... What are you?
Well,
I need blood dripping down my chin.
No, so yeah. Well, so me, it's more just like, what's the most unhealthy vegetarian food that you can find?
What does that exist? Is that an oxymoron?
I know. Well, that's what I mean. It becomes quite a challenge.
I will have a deep fried mushroom.
It's really hard to punish yourself. Like, you know what I mean? Like,
punishing yourself enough.
It makes it.
You're already punishing
really
yourself enough, mate. You're not having a nice steak, you know? Hello to all our vegan friends. Cheers. Don't bother writing to me. You do you, I'll do me. Yes.
So what do you eat when you...
Anything I can get my hands on, honestly. I'm Italian, so I'll go to my dad's and I just sit at the table and I say, Vinci, feed me. And it will, and it is just the most joyous thing. My dad's a feeder. So I was spending a lot of time around at my parents' house eating. Luckily, I was pregnant. Oh, God, I ate. If you lost your appetite last year, I found it, Melbourne, Australia. Oh, my fucking God, I ate so much. I was eating baked potatoes and I'd have like bacon, cream cheese, avocado, mince. I was making my own one and I'd just sit there and I was eating a couple spuds a day. And then sometimes...
This is not
really
a plug
desperate
for Spud Bar.
Oh,
but
sorry.
You don't have to be sorry because I'm about to say I also... talking comfort food.
Oh, Spud like Bar.
Spud Bar is... Oh. They should say... That should be their slogan, Spud Bar.
Sad people.
Are you going through something? Spud Bar.
Oh, no.
How are you?
This should just be deep depression, Spud. Yeah. Breaking up with my boyfriend, Spud.
Spud Bar. This will fill the hole inside you.
Oh, my God. We are writing it for them. But I got so desperate, Will, I would drive to a Westfield food court.
Yeah.
And be there waiting for the 15-year-olds to pull the spuds out of it. And it's a fucking sad place, the Westfield Food Court, at 9 a.m. on a weekday. It's not good for your mental health to be sitting there. With the unemployed and the kids wagging school.
When are the spuds done?
And so I'd be there with like bacon all over my face. If there's security cameras from that time, fuck, there's just this sad, enormous pregnant woman crying into her baked potato. And I carried around a 16-pack of Ferrero Rochers in my backpack. Like... Just in case I got hungry, just popped a few. I like, thank fuck I was pregnant. But I just ate. I was eating all the time and that was what I was doing with my rage. But I was also writing it all down, which is very helpful for a show. I just wrote a lot. And when I no one should ever read the things that I wrote down last year. That reminds me to set those things on fire very soon. I wrote down the most awful, horrible things that I was feeling and thinking that I've been able to pull a few things.
Yeah.
But a lot of it was just to get the sticky thoughts out of my brain and out of my fingers.
And out of your body a little bit.
Out of my body.
Because once you – well, tell me about how you feel about this, but I imagine that you're having so many conversations in your head. Mm-hmm. You're constantly in your head refuting arguments, you know, like being obsessed by something that was written that was wrong and you're like in your head, you're coming up with your revenge plan or your whatever or just like, you know, the myriad of conversations, the myriad of emotions.
Yeah.
Just the act of putting them down on a piece of paper and they go, okay, they don't have to be up here anymore.
Yeah.
They're down there.
Yeah. I do that. Do you do that?
I mean, I have done that. Mm. I certainly found after I did the show about being arrested, because that was a majorly traumatic time in my life that I spent a lot of time, you know, doing the process of getting it from being something that was really traumatic for me to go through. Because essentially, you know, it's a story about me being arrested for something that I didn't do. Mm. Like it's a, you know, it was a, I had a little bit of post-traumatic stress. I had all these things that I was dealing with and I had to move it from the conversations I was having in my head, re-prosecuting the entire day, you know, get it on paper and like you, if anybody saw the aggrieved, punished by the world.
Oh, the like, victim. You know, I was a
sad,
victim.
Emo 15-year-old, you know, like that
you.
Version of it.
Oh,
so,
my God.
So I say that to... you know, to give you some to at least give some context of, I have some understanding of that. So then how did you process it from being, you know, the victim, angry, sad, on paper stuff into a show? How does that process go?
Well, as the pregnancy progressed, I guess I got really into my body. And as you know, when you start paying attention to your body, your mind stops wondering. You know, the best thing to do, people talk about exercise, is when you're feeling really shitty, get in your body, go and do something that puts you in the moment. So as I got more pregnant and I realized this baby was coming, I just was able to let it go. So I think the moment I truly let it all go was the moment they laid Elio on my chest. And I looked up at Scotty and the girls were there, and I had all my most important, my best friend Michael was there, and my parents were there, and I had all my people were in one room. And I'm like, this is all that matters. Mm. This is all that matters. And no one can take this moment away from me, no matter what they write about me.
Well,
if my career tanks tomorrow.
One person can. Me. You can.
Yeah. And I am a horrific self-sabotager. I will push people away before they have a chance to reject me. That is my MO. That is something I think I behave in such an appalling way just to be able to say, see, when they finally leave because I've pushed them so hard, see, I was right. I'm glad I didn't put any effort into getting to know you. So I spend my life holding people at arm's length, and I think I'm so loud and I'm so desperate to fill the space so that nobody else tries to step in and fill the space toward me. And it takes a long time for me to trust people and feel comfortable. You know, I've had all the same friends since I was a teenager. It's taken Scott, my husband, 19 years to truly get close to me. My parents probably still working at it. But but then there are certain...
Well, I don't know who said it. I've quoted different people and I'm actually not sure who originally said it. But, you know, there's a theory that a lot of comedians become comedians so that they can choose how people laugh at them.
Yeah.
That, you know, that we know that people are going to laugh at us.
Well, that makes me really sad.
But by being a comedian,
yeah,
you get to control how people laugh at you. So this sense of you pushing, opening yourself to the audience, but at the same time pushing people away
that are closest to me
is, completely understandable. But at the other end of the spectrum, you know, the mistake that we can make, and, you know, certainly I've been guilty of making this myself, is that, like you said, it was the people in that room that care.
Yeah.
And the only person who can take them away from you is you caring about all these other assholes who you'll never meet, that you never see day to day, you're never going to run into once.
No.
It matters whether, you know, like, it matters whether your partner is angry at you for not taking the rubbish out a lot more than it matters what somebody wrote on news.com.au.
Yeah. It's so true. And yet we give the best of ourselves and all of our energy to the people that matter the least.
Yeah.
And then the ones that you love and are closest to, they get the dregs. Mm.
Like, I find it hard enough. I'm here by myself at the moment we were having a chat beforehand. And, you know, so it's just me and the two dogs and a cat, you know. And even that. Even coming home to have the energy every day to make sure that they're walked and loved and washed and fed and I make them food and blah, blah, blah. By the time you do that and your job, the amount of energy you have for anyone else or anything else is drained from you. And I think part of it is it's not just the hours.
No.
But it's the fact that you're doing a show. You're the classic, my dad's got a barn. We found these costumes. We're putting on a show.
100%. And just so everyone remembers, my dad now sits on the stage in my band and is forced to watch the shows at a very close proximity.
Dad.
Yeah.
Dad.
Look at me. Look at me. Look at me. Look. Look now. 100%. That is me. I love performing. I'm not very good with small groups of people. I'm great with 3,000. Not so great with 5.
Well, that's okay. That's an okay thing to realize about
yourself. Oh, look, can I tell you, every week I learn something new that I think I wake up and go, I'm a good person now. And then I'll catch myself in something and go, oh, fuck, you got a bit of work to do. You are a despicable. Every week I'm learning something because I've put myself in a space where I want to clear anxiety from my calendar. Mm. I want to clear guilt from my calendar. I'm 40 years old. I spent so much of the last 40 years micromanaging people's opinions of me, micromanaging my opinions, micromanaging my thoughts, controlling who I am for certain people, that I now just want to exhale and I want to be able to sleep well and I don't want to walk around with a pit in my stomach. So now I'm just, I've got snoring.
Yeah, well, the only thing you've got on your stomach at the moment is a snoring dog.
Well, I'm very entertaining.
Yeah, it is a tough question to ask yourself, what is the best version of me?
Mm.
And it can be quite a confronting move because society is set up, and it's just the way society is, that to measure success based on the measurements that society has decided what success looks like. But I look at you today, like, you know, and I've seen you through this entire process. Like, you look like a different person. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. You just look beautiful. You have this great new haircut. You look so, yeah, happy and at peace. I can't believe that you've got a show in 3 days. Like, I mean, you don't look like you do. You just look happy. And yes, as you said, you know, maybe you're on a journey, and of course we all are, right? You know, maybe if we were doing this tomorrow, you might have had a different day, and you might not look like that. But you look like a different person.
Yeah.
You look 5 years younger. You look, you know, 100 times happier.
Mm. Like, I am.
And to hear you talk, you know, it's like talking to a different person.
Yeah. I feel, like I said, I listened to us a couple of weeks ago, and it was like listening to someone else. And I wanted to go to her and give her a hug. I was just so unhappy. And now I feel full and happy and joyful. And I've got this baby that is a constant reminder of what's really important. Because like I said, when they put him on my chest, everything came into focus. And the only other time I have that is when I step out on stage. And when I step out onto stage, I can't not be funny. I can't hit a bad note. Like, I feel like I'm on my track and I'm doing what I'm supposed to be doing.
So I want to talk about the show because, so how old is your baby?
Nearly 6 months.
So did you plan, like, when did you decide that 6 months into having a baby, you were going to have another baby? You know, you were going to have the performer
like,
baby.
Exactly.
You know, like,
when
you,
I was pregnant.
Did you not think,
no, I did.
I'll give myself like another 6 months up my sleeve?
I should have. And you know what, Will, about 8 weeks ago, I'm like, what the fuck was I thinking? You know, when I was having a personal silent breakdown over a few things, I was like, how the fuck? Because at that point in time, he was waking up every 90 minutes at night. And even then, it was fine. I'm happy to get up to him because I'm so glad he's here. But he started sleeping through this week, little champion.
Oh, well done.
He just knew.
Good on you, mate.
You know, good on you, Elio. I should have waited longer, but look. To be fair, I was answering emails the day I gave birth on my phone in the hospital. That's who I am. I love working. I love my job. Even if I don't make stuff, I go a bit nutty. Mm. So it's okay. It's people around me are used to it. I have a great team that when I throw ideas out, they catch it and they make it a reality. And I mean, that's all I've ever wanted my whole life. And I pick the people around me and we complement each other and they keep me in check and, you know, I'm just really lucky that I now am in a place where I can say the things I want to do and then I have the right people to make them for me.
Okay, so tell me then, I want to know about the show.
Okay,
I want to know.
Okay.
I want to know, like, what it looks like, how many people are involved.
Okay.
You've kind of hinted at what it's about, but what's the structure of it? I want to, like, you know, I want to know about, you know, this bit of work that you've created out of all this.
I know. It's, well, God, it's a touring company of 20.
I mean, I've seen you post some photos and I was like, whew, that is a...
It's expensive.
It's a whole lot of people.
It's an expensive tour.
Like,
don't worry.
Got to sell a bunch of tickets, Em.
Well, if I was you and it was just me on stage with a stool and my fucking bottle of water, I would be not working again for quite some time.
I mean, it's an economical business model.
It would be amazing. And I'm really thinking about that for next year, guys. Let's be real. I also have 12 dancing vaginas to wrangle. So it's a company of 32. Mm-hmm. And look, 6 years ago, I could only afford Dad and I. Mm. So I have to also go, I'm now in a position where I can employ really talented people to help me. And
Dad, the good news is I can pay you and the 12 dancing vaginas. Dad doesn't get paid.
No, he won't take my money. Wog.
Really?
Nah. He says it's all going to go to you anyway, so what's the point?
Oh, well, I mean.
I bought him a car. That was like my dad's a massive F1 fan, loves cars. Like Daniel Ricciardo is a god. And he's always wanted a specific type of car. And I was able to buy that for him. Yeah. Nice. Could not buy it now. Thank God I got it in then. So this show involves.
I'm sure he's also happy with the 12 dancing vaginas.
He loves them. They're amazing. They're classically trained, Will. I'll tell you about those questions.
Classically trained as dancers or vaginas?
Both. Vulvas, if we're being correct. Vulvas.
Oh, yeah, okay, yes.
But no, the show involves an 8-piece band, me. I've had a set built. I always wanted to. So it's kind of this huge rainbow that spans the entire stage. There's clouds.
Why the rainbow? What's the rainbow about?
The rainbow represents a lot of things. The rainbow represents... Well, the LGBTQI community is very important to me and have always been very supportive, and I love them, and it's kind of my salute to them. The babies that are born after you lose a baby are referred to as rainbow babies. Okay. And I guess, you know, the idea that you get to the end of the rainbow and you know, you find that thing that you've been looking for, that's also there. Also, I can be described as a rage-filled rainbow. I think that could probably be the name of an autobiography or something. So I also wanted to balance out, if I'm being honest, the rage title. I knew that was going to be confronting, which is why I am majestically resplendent on a unicorn in my posters, because I knew that if I just had rage, people would be like, is it just her screaming on stage, throwing her period blood at people for 90 minutes? And look, when I first started out, that was definitely a possibility.
First draft.
Yeah, wearing the scream mask. Just on the ground in the fetal position. It was a real performance piece. Yeah. Throwing menstrual blood at people's faces. Just yelling, fuck you.
Yeah.
We came a long way from that.
It's 8,000 words, but most of them are fuck and you.
Yeah, there's a lot of fisting there's
a good fisting bit you'll enjoy.
So I guess this show's kind of this exploration, this of my rage, and hopefully other people will watch it. And I'm a storytelling person. I've also let go of the comic tag. I'm a bit of everything now, and I think I got so hung up on being referred to as a stand-up comic. I got really upset when Tom Gleason just kept calling me a live performer, and then I thought about that, and I thought, well, you know, whatever. So I don't know. I've taken the word comic off all my bios. I'm a community now, so which I kind of love. So the show, I wrote five original songs for this show, which I've never done. And I wrote them with Kate Miller-Heike.
Now, I was watching Ramona. She gets obsessed with bottles.
What's wrong, Ramona? No, well, you know what it is. She loves your bottles.
It's the bottle.
Yeah.
And so, but she can't have that bottle because there's water in that bottle. And so now I have to hide it so that she doesn't. Like half of her is on my tracksuit.
Look at she. Like I'm covered in the dog hair. Ramona, you're so needy.
There you go.
Yay.
She loves taking the lids off bottles. It's like as soon as any bottle looks like it's about to be empty,
she's there.
Then that's her little she'll enjoy that. She'll take the lid off and then she'll get bored of it. But
I love that dog. Yeah, so original songs, which I've never done. Because I do want to record this one and get it out to the masses eventually. So, yeah, I heard Muriel's Wedding, the musical, the soundtrack, and fell in love with it and found out that Kate Miller-Heike had written it. So I said, I really want songs like this. And my friend Michael said, why don't you just ask Kate if she'll write with you? And I said, there's no way.
Did you know Kate?
No, never met her. Just was always a fan. So I was really nervous. Like, why the fuck would she do this? She's credible. She's amazing. She's got all these things going. Why would she work with someone like me? And she said yes straight away. And it was joyous. And, I mean, I think she thought.
So how does that even happen?
Oh, I was so nervous.
Tell me about how it happens.
I saw that she followed me on Instagram. Uh-huh. So I sent her a slid into her DMs.
Yeah.
And I said, hey, crazy idea. Completely understand if you feel insulted I'm even asking you, but you know, I had to ask. Loved Muriel's Wedding, loved all the songs. I'm writing a show, I really want to do originals. Here's the vibe of the show, and I kind of laid out the ideas behind, you know, the all the stories. And she came straight back and she said, yeah, I'd love to, let's meet up. So I met her and her partner Kia, who she writes with, and also her partner. And I explained the show again to them, and I guess seeing me with all my hands and all my earrings and glitter, and they were like, yeah, we'll do, we've never done anything like this. So to their credit, fucking hell. And they just came on this journey, and I would send them lyric ideas and send them script bits, and they'd send me music. And then so the songs, some of them are funny, some of them are not funny, they're poignant. And I'm so glad they're out there. They're on Spotify. Anyone can listen to them. But I'm really proud that I've got original songs in. It's just, as also a musician, I always felt uncomfortable doing covers and parodies. I really wanted to challenge myself. So,
and so the songs are already out there. So
yeah, they're
like,
out there.
So like a concert, people can kind of listen to
which
the
songs. Which is why I did it.
And
yes.
Come along and
sing
actually
along.
Sing along.
Because you hate going to a show where they won't sing their hits. Mm. You know, they want to give you the new experimental stuff. And you're like, oh, for fuck's sake, Prince, just do Purple Rain. So
I went to see Prince.
Me too.
He was doing in LA. He was doing this. So it was 20 nights at the Forum for $20 or something ridiculous like that. I can't remember if that was what it was, but the Forum, which is like 15,000 or whatever it is, he did 20 nights in a row, but I think the tickets were only, anyway, there was some ridiculously low price. It might have been, but then they were all on, you know, resale for.
Yeah. Yeah, so, way more.
Certainly by the time I bought my ticket, it was not available for $20. However, I went by myself and I was just in town and I went out to see Prince and he at one stage, because so I was in the round, you know, and so one corner of the stage had a piano.
Yeah.
And the show went probably two and a half, 3 hours.
Yes, they normally do.
But he at one stage he was on the piano and he would play like, you know, six bars from Cream and then six bars from something else. And in between he just go, too many hits. I've got too many hits.
Rest in peace, Magnificent.
I was just like, I was like, that is a bold claim. But then after 2.5 hours where you're like, oh no, you do have too many hits. You no way you could have fit those songs in.
I so love him. Oh my God, yes. Oh, I saw him. It's the greatest concert I've ever been to. I wept 3.5 hours, didn't leave the stage. Oh God.
Yeah, he was.
Gives.
Funnily enough, I'd never. I mean, I was aware of Prince's music, but it just hadn't been like my passion.
Yeah.
But you know, I was. Someone I respected had raved about these shows, and I was just like, you know what, I should go and. Mm-hmm. And then from then on, I was just like, oh, Prince is one of the greatest entertainers I've ever seen 100%. In my entire life.
Yeah. Which is, and I take. I think I with the way I perform. I've taken a lot from Prince, a lot from Freddie. I strut around the stage in a leotard with wings, and like, and I know that he's kind of politically incorrect now, but the first comedy special I ever saw was Eddie Murphy Raw. Mm. My dad bought it for me, and we had it on vinyl, and then I watched him in that red leather.
Right. He's 20, 21 years old or whatever he was when he did that, and he's dressed head to toe.
Red leather.
In a red leather
outfit. And I just
thought,
that's how you deliver comedy.
Well, I mean, he was like a.
It was incredible. He was.
I mean, there is this thing now, and I can be as guilty of this as anyone, which is the, you know, like look like you barely, you know, dressed up out of you, got out of bed.
See, I don't subscribe to that.
Stand next
I don't
to a
subscribe
stool,
to that at all.
Have a beer.
No.
You know.
I don't want to look like crew. No. I don't want to look like the crew. There's to be no mistaking me for the fucking riggers. No, because will my audience have to take a run up to coming to see me?
Yeah.
A lot of them are mothers. A lot of them are women who run things. And so they've got to arrange the babysitter. And I started a Facebook group for all the people attending because I wanted a lot of people come by themselves. And so there's 3,000 members on the Facebook group already. And they've all started making friends and they're all going to meet up. They're posting their outfits, they're posting where they're going for dinner. And so who am I to get on stage without some fucking effort? Some would say I've taken it a bit too far.
Well, I don't think so, though, because what you've created is
an experience.
Yes. And it adds to the experience.
Yes.
Particularly if you're inviting people who can go, I can do this by myself. I don't need to have a friend.
Yeah.
I will make a friend.
They always do.
You know?
Yeah.
And so suddenly you've got this like community like, you know, the Grateful Dead have or like, you know, Barry Manilow has. You know, like I mean, but do you mean like these people who have these, you know, fans who are obsessed with their career, but part of their social group is also the idea of going, you know, not only am I going to go out and see M, but I'm going to go out and see, these other five women that I only see when we all go and see M.
Yes. And it's the most wonderful thing because I know what it is to be lonely and it's hard to make friends as an adult. It's hard to make new friends, meaningful friendships that you meet up with face-to-face, not just flick a text to every now and then. So if I can be the catalyst for meaningful friendships amongst adult women, fuck, my job's done. But Yeah, so the, what were we talking about? Oh, the songs.
Yes.
So they're, yeah.
So five songs?
I want five.
Five original songs.
Five originals, then I've got a couple other ones I've mucked around with. But yeah, so I wanted people to be able to sing along, basically. So that's why they're out there. It opens on a huge, big number called Rage Like a Motherfucker. I think you'll enjoy that. You should listen to it later. And then the show just goes about kind of plotting the last 12 months in where I turned 40 and had a baby and all the little kind of seeds of rage, how they were sown in, but also the way that I unpacked them and then joyfully unloaded them. And I'm kind of gently sharing the techniques with the audience where we get to the end of the entire production, which is hopefully 90 minutes, but knowing me, it'll be 120.
Yeah.
Where everyone gets up and feels lighter. And that's all I can hope is that people will walk out and go, ah, okay, fine, good. This isn't such a dark place, because I like to pick topics that are sticky and awful and hard and shine light into the corners of them, because, you know, I think that's my job as a comedian and a performer and taking awful, hard things and finding the humor in them and finding a way to survive them. And survive being a human, because honestly, Will, every day I just try to make sure the world doesn't swallow me whole. And if it hasn't, I have to say to myself, it was a good day today.
So tell me then, you know, a couple of days out, you know, how are you sleeping? Where's your head at? What are your sort of fears and doubts? What are your hopes and ambitions?
Yes.
Like, you know, all those things, because, you know, every performer is different, but, you know, there's been times over the last, you know, 6 months or so, where I imagine that if somebody came up to you and gave you a decent excuse not to have to do it all, you would have taken it.
I've done that last night.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Well, there you go.
Just fluctuate. We had the big tech run Monday and I forgot 90% of what I wanted to say. And normally that's not a big deal, because I do a lot of improv. I'm very much a person who will have a chat with an audience member and I'll make half a show out of what we talk about. I mean, I don't have a problem doing that. But I feel a great sense of responsibility with this show, because it has such an important thing, and that I want to stop the women of Australia self-harming by holding in how they're really feeling. And so that's really important to me. So I want to remember the jokes, and I want to remember the research, and I want to remember it all, because it's important. It's not just me up on stage telling fart jokes this time or telling funny stories that only I know if I've fucked up or missed a punchline. So I feel a sense of responsibility to get the material out as I intended it to be received, not in some weird, convoluted, drunken, stupid way that sometimes it can. As you know, I mean, it gets a bit. So I feel that sense of responsibility. I'm really excited. I've stopped sleeping. I run the opening monologue when I go to sleep at night, and then if I can't run it perfect, I get up and read it again. I don't know. I want as many people eyes on this show as possible, but I'm worried the titles turn them off. I mean, I've sold pretty well. I'm about 80% sold out around the country and sold out in Melbourne this weekend, which is so great, because it's two sold out shows at Hamer Hall, which, you know, I didn't think I'd ever be able to say.
I mean, it's amazing. Like, I mean, that's, and I imagine the rest of it will follow if you're 80% sold it. Like, you're one of those people that, like, for the rest of us, going in at 80% sold before you've started a run is like, well, that's a sold out run, because it'll get sold out.
I'm obsessively checking.
But
the
you're like,
numbers.
If it's not all sold out before you get there, you're like, it's okay. Even you two have still got a few tickets
to
sell. It's fine.
My poor Frontier Touring, the lady in charge of ticketing, Heather, like, I know in my mind that there are still two wheelchair access seats at the top, right at the top balcony at Hamer Hall on Saturday night, that still are sitting there. Because I just go in and obsessively check the numbers every day. I'm not supposed to, and everyone's been told, don't send her the numbers. So I hacked in on my manager's email, which I have access to, and I was able to get those emails funneled to me so I could check the numbers.
Why do you care about the numbers?
Because it's a sense of, it's like feedback, it's validation. Validation in numbers, because I'm a needy fucking performer that needs to know people care enough to buy a ticket.
But what's the difference between 1,998 people or 2,000 people?
298 people.
Okay. Well, yeah, so that's what I mean.
It's,
like,
it's true. You know. Oh, no, don't worry. I'm self-aware that I'm a fucking lunatic. I just can't stop it. But no, I mean, look, I mean, this will go Brisbane, Perth, Adelaide, you guys are still to come.
And, where are you playing in Brisbane?
In a stupidly huge venue. It's like a 5,000-seater.
What venue is it?
Entertainment Centre.
Okay, yeah, yeah, I played that. Yeah. Okay, yeah, yeah.
You're willing. Oh, yeah, you've got some followers. Tell them to come see me.
Yeah, well, this is the whole point of this. Good,
please come. Please come Perth.
It's okay.
I'm playing Riverside Theatre at Perth, Federation
Concert
Hall. Oh, yeah,
so the Riverside's, have you played there before?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, but that's good though. Yeah. You like that?
Federation Concert Hall in Hobart, and then I'm playing State Theatre in Sydney, which is sold out, and then I've got Emmore, which has still got a couple hundred seats
left. Have you done the State Theatre before in Sydney?
Yes, did that last year.
So I've never performed on, well, you know what, I've done, I think, a gala stand-up gig, but I've watched, because I do the Opera House.
Yeah, I did that last year. That's great.
But the State Theatre is, to go and watch a show is one of my favourite places. It's such a beautiful theatre. Mm. Like, I do, at some stage, I will, like, I'd like to do a show at the stage.
You should.
Because I do find it a beautiful, beautiful theatre.
It is. And all the walls, like, when those 12 dancing vulvas come out at the State Theatre, what a stunning moment. What a stunning moment for art, you know, for culture. Can't wait. No, but I mean, look, I want as many eyes on, because I think it's really going to help and entertain. And I don't know, I've just said to Scott, I'm really panicked. My intended audience, not enough of them are going to see it. So that's why I'm kind of obsessed with selling it.
Yeah. So who's the intended audience then? Tell me who you imagine the audience is.
Well, I imagine the audience to be confused and bewildered men who aren't sure what's going on with the women in their lives and the women in their lives.
Yeah.
So everyone. This show is important. You know how it's really important that Channel 10 and Channel 7 screen that Adam Goods documentary?
Yeah.
Like, we don't need to see that on the ABC. We don't need to see that on SBS.
Oh, yeah, okay. I understand the point Adam you're making. Goods, like, the point being is, like, you don't need to show it to the people who already understand it. You need to show it to the people who may understand it if they take the time to think about it, or if someone says it in the way that...
Yeah.
Go, you know, to a bunch of people who will get it.
They'll get it as soon as I say it.
If it's presented to them in the right way.
And it is. It's presented to you by a woman in a rainbow leotard with cloud shoulder pads on a unicorn. It's presented to you in a way that is totally palatable, which was very intended on my behalf. And also it is important for the women it's about to see it, because I want them to go, oh, fuck, I'm not losing my mind. Yeah. In fact, they're going to look around and see a bunch of women in the room nodding and smiling. And, you know, and rage like a motherfucker, my truest wish is we're going to walk out and the last thing, the Hamer Hall, you know, this weekend, it's sold out. All these women just screaming, you're about to see me rage like a motherfucker. And they're going to sing that like a motherfucker bit. And I just want all the music to drop and just hear them chanting that. And that's the rock concert for me.
So that's the ambition. That's the ambition. Hope. If it works out how... Yeah. Okay, so that's... On its best day, that's what it feels like.
I'm worried.
What are the worries that you have?
That I won't remember everything. Yeah, other than that, I'm not worried about my ability to perform. The music sounds incredible. My band sound amazing. I've tried to get mostly female players this year, which sadly wasn't easy.
Why do you think that it isn't easy?
I think because... a lot of really top level session musos are blokes who tend to recommend other blokes who, it's just because the women, they're really good. They're just not given the opportunities to come through. So I really went on a search to find female players. So I've got a great drummer, Alex. She's amazing. Phoebe on bass, my two backing vocalists, Olivia, Jess. And like, my dad's there too. You know, he's there 'cause he's free. Nah, I'm joking. Yeah, I'm just worried I won't get out everything I want to get out. That's the only worry. It's me. And again, the only person who can stuff this up is me.
Well, the other problem though is that it's a hard show to do a bunch of trial shows in a 100-seat theatre. Do you know what I mean? You can't.
No.
You can't.
Do you know I never do trial shows? Do you know the first time I run the show was opening night?
Yeah, at Hamer Hall.
Mm-hmm. And I've done that for 10 years. This is my 10th solo show. And I've never, ever, you know what else though, Will? I don't like running it because I don't want the magic to leave the words.
Yeah.
And I want to be believable when I'm delivering it. And when I deliver stuff, I'm in the moment with it. I'm never just on a script. You'll never catch me just voicing a script. So I'm scared to run it too many times because I want the band to react naturally. And I also want the magic to stay in the words and the way I deliver it. So I want it to still be new. So I don't run a bunch of practice or I have confidence that it's funny. I know it's funny. And the songs are incredible. I know I'm a good singer. Like, all the elements are there. I just have to put it together. And I've put a year into it. And I'm really good at what I do. So I just have to kind of pep talk myself into that.
physically, what sort of strain is it on you? Like, what sort of physical shape do you have to get into to do a show?
I'm not in any sort of shape. My hip's fucked, and I know I'm saying it to a kindred spirit.
Stop
there.
Stop doing my material.
Sorry, but my hip is fucked.
I do the stuff about my hips being fucked.
So sorry.
You can have your
why are you wearing all black and black nail polish and a black beanie and black Nikes?
You can have your fucking rainbow.
Guys, I got arrested last year. I don't know if you've heard. I know. My body's a part of the show. Will is talking about being a geriatric pregnant lady and what it does to your body. And you're not supposed to be pregnant in your 40s. That's not what nature intends. Your body just fucking's like, what the fuck are you doing, girl? So everything's gone to shit. I've got a eight finger tear in my abdominal wall, which is causing my lower back to be fucked. My hips are fucked. My knees are fucked. I did knee slides last year during the show, which I shouldn't have done. And I fucked one of my knees doing a knee slide over the giant penis. I'm not even going to explain that.
How'd you hurt your knee? Wow.
Wow.
It's a funny story.
Huge cock. Not explaining it. You can't make me. Not explaining it. I've neglected my physical shape completely. So it's going to be a suck it and see. Really, I'm in the camp of hope for the best at this point in time. I'm wearing my surgery undies under my leotard, so it's great. They suck everything in, tuck everything in, but it also supports my abdominal wall and my hip. I don't know what's going to happen. I'm wearing platform runners on stage for the first time in my whole career because I just can't do heels anymore. I've given up tampons, G-strings and heels as I've turned 40. Because he can be fucked with any of those things.
I mean, okay. Well, at least there's no crossover in our material.
Have you given up tampons, G-strings and heels?
Well, I mean, I guess technically. You've given up is probably the wrong way of putting it. But I also feel no need for
I'm
them.
I'm telling you, all your female listeners will understand when I say when I've given up tampons. They're too much stress. They're very stressful.
Well, so, I mean, this is, like you said, the idea of, you know, you're singing about, you know, geriatric pregnancy for example. But it is something that more and more women.
Most women wait till later in life.
So, as times change, these topics, become relevant to this audience, that haven't had anybody really talking about these things previously.
But that's why I do it. I kind of fill the void that I'd be the person I would like to see and be and need. I'm the person I needed a year ago, right now. I am the person I needed.
So you've kind of written a show. For you a year ago.
Yeah, I have.
You a year ago, come and sit in the audience of this show and I'll teach you what you need to know about what's going on.
Yeah, pretty much. And that...
Well, that's a good idea for a show.
Yeah.
That feels to me like that'll be a really great show.
I think it's coming from a real good place.
Yeah.
It's coming from no spite, it's coming from... It's made from love, not for love. And I think... anything you do in that way holds you in good stead.
What's your day like when you... So what's Friday going to look like for you? Like, what's your ideal preparation?
Oh, God. I'm so nervous. You just made my... I just got sweaty.
Do you have a way to sleep? Like, do you worry that you... Like, I mean...
I'm not going to sleep.
You won't
sleep. I won't sleep. I mean, I'll cat nap.
Yeah.
I've got an elderly dog that wakes up every couple hours now, so I'm dealing with him. The baby started sleeping through, which is great. Mm. I've got to be at Hamer Hall by 12:30 and we've got to run a full production check for all the lighting because I've got John Farnham's lighting guy, Chris Newman. He's lit every single John Farnham show and every single John Farnham film clip. He's amazing. I'm so excited. I love John Farnham. He's my favourite singer. Favourite person of all time. I love him. So,
have you met John Farnham?
No. I've interviewed him once down the line. I cried. I burst into tears and I completely ignored Olivia Newton-John for 12 minutes.
How would you feel if John Farnham came and saw the show?
I've asked, I've begged, I've tried.
Oh, really?
He doesn't leave his house. He just likes to fish on his trout farm and then he goes to Africa to take photos. So last year, Will, I did a whole show with John Farnham's band and everyone was there except Farnham. So Chong Lim was there. Brett Garcet, who's played guitar on every single track he's ever done. His lighting guy, his drummer, Jerry. I had John's literal entire band. They all went and told John about it. I did John Farnham material. I think it's fair to say John Farnham has sent the message.
Yeah. John knows. John knows you're interested.
John knows.
And John has just expressed his lack of interest.
John has politely declined with his deafening silence.
Yeah, right.
Jimmy Barnes has been great. I also love Jimmy. Like, I'm a secret Aussie bogan at heart. I love Jimmy Barnes and John Farnham, my two faves. So Jimmy's been very lovely, and we actually got nominated against each other for a book award, and he beat me, whatever. And then when I told him I was going to start writing erotic fiction, he's like, yeah, I'm going to start writing fiction too. I'm like, fuck off, Barnes. Leave that area for me, thank you. So, John Farnham came to my show. You've really distracted me. I get there and we run a full production thing, and then we do sound check, and then the Dancing Vaginas turn up and we have a run with the Dancing Vaginas because in each state I've hired 12 local dancers who have just graduated dance school. They're all 18-year-olds. Yeah. Some are boys. Their faces are where the clitoris goes. Uh-huh. The costumes came from Brooklyn because I found an important
lesson for men in the audience.
Very much so. Do you see where the face is?
If there's a subtle message out of the
face
show.
Face marks the spot, guys.
I'd like you to take home.
See the whole head. Here's a clue. Yeah, it's like you read my script. I know. Yeah, pretty much a great diagram. They came from Brooklyn because I found out if you bought these costumes, a portion of the money gets donated to women's charities in New York.
Okay, great.
But then they got sent over and they got held hostage by customs, and this guy kept ringing me saying, what's in these boxes? It just says conceived in Brooklyn. That's all that was written on it. And I said, they're just costumes for my show. And he's like, well, what are they? And I said, they're giant vulvas. And then they got held hostage again by FedEx because I had to pay the GST on them.
Oh, yeah, okay, right.
So they were like, I just couldn't. And I thought, I'm never going to get
these vulvas.
The shipping was, the costumes were only $1,200 for 12. The shipping was $4,000.
Yeah, exactly.
I nearly died. Yeah. So those vaginas better fucking pay for themselves, mate. I'm going to auction them after. I'm going to sign the flaps and I'm going to auction them after. So, but the reason the vaginas are there is because it's not, you know, there's a reason. There's a very important reason, and I'll leave you on this because I feel like I've probably spoken enough. I want to encourage women and men to flap up, basically, because the vagina, the vulva, is the strongest part of the body. It gives life and it can take life if you do enough pelvic floor exercises. So I want that lasting image for the women to be these majestic spinning vulvas being strong and powerful, and that is a metaphor for them to just remember to believe in that part of themselves, in that womanly part, that women are strong and it's okay to be strong. It's not masculine or ball-breaking. Or terrifying or all the words that we get called. It's a beautiful thing. A strong woman, is there anything more beautiful than a strong woman?
Well, so, I don't think there is, Em, and that's why I have always been such a great admirer of yours, and that I for whatever happened in your life, and I know a lot of it was really traumatic, I feel like, you know, the gift that I got out of it. And, you know, I'm sure that we could have come up with another way to do this that would have been much more pleasant. But the gift that I got out of it is that sometimes if you are side by side with somebody when they're experiencing a trauma, it artificially accelerates the intimacy that you have with that person. Mm. You know, like people who go to war together or people who have some traumatic experience together that they share, you know, it kind of cuts you through a bunch of layers of bullshit into a... like a level of, so we don't, you know, now that we're not in the same building, we don't see each other with the frequency we do, but we occasionally, you know, just think of each other and exchange a message or whatever. And I certainly, you know, I genuinely appreciate that. And it's been nice to kind of, get to, feel like that we have a bond.
We do.
You know, and that, you know, we got to do this and I'm really excited for the show. So Friday and Saturday at Hamer Hall.
At Hamer Hall, then I go to Hobart, then I go to Adelaide, then I go to Perth, then I go to Brisbane, then I go to Sydney. But on that...
How would you feel if I came to
the
show?
I was going to ask you, do you want to... Like, I've been really nervous. I've got a ticket for you, two tickets for you. Do you want to just come and sit side of stage? Do you want to come?
How would you feel about that if I came?
I would be so excited for you to see me because you've never seen me.
No, not like this. No, not at all.
And I feel like
you need to. But would you feel okay if I came?
Yes, I would love for you to come. But I was nervous to ask because I didn't know if you'd want to. No, I can't get Husey to a show. Like, I can't get the blokes I love because I think they're almost frightened at what they're gonna see. But I would love for you to come. Oh my God, I'm so nervous right now. If you want to come, I of course want you to come. I want you to see me, the best version of me.
Yeah, well, I think I should sit in the audience because I want to see, like, I mean, it feels to me like a show that, you know, you need to see from the front, not the side.
Do you want to like sit with Creasy? Do you want to sit with like people you know?
Yeah, that'd be good.
Do you want to sit with Creasy?
Yeah, can I do that?
Yeah,
when's he coming?
Friday night, opening night.
Friday night.
Yeah.
All right, I'm in.
Claire Bowditch will be there. Do you know Claire?
Yeah. She'll be there. Yeah,
I'll sit you with them.
Okay, that'd be great.
I'll tell Joel you're meeting him.
Yeah, all right.
All right.
Friday night.
I'm so nervous.
Hey, Mahal.
Oh, my God.
All right, yeah, I'm coming.
Are you sure? Because if you don't come, I'll be very upset.
No.
If you can't bail on me.
No, I wouldn't have brought it up if I didn't.
Oh, my God. All right, well, then you can do it. You can tell people what you think. Before I go, I just want to thank you for seeing me because you see me. Like you see me. And that's when I left the podcast last time. I'm getting teary. I felt seen by someone that I respect and admire and who does what I want to be able to do so brilliantly. Like you're our best comic in this country and best performer and someone whose opinion I value. And I felt seen and I continue to feel seen by you. And you can't imagine how comforting that is. So know that you provide me with immense self-confidence and comfort in doing what I do. And that's a gift that you don't know how valuable that is to me, Will. So thank you very much for that. It's incredible.
Well, thank you for saying that. That's very nice of you. And I'm glad that you came and did this. And let's stop so that I can.
Are you really coming? Are you coming?
Yes, absolutely. Well, I wouldn't have just said it.
Okay, great.
I've said it on the podcast. No, I definitely. As long as
you're
cool with me coming.
I'd love for you to be there, but just know the whole audience is going to be watching you throughout the whole show.
Well, that's what I was going to say. That's why I want to sit next to Creasy because I can put my beanie on and he'll want to be seen.
So
that'll be fine. He can be my. He can be my shield.
Thank you for having me. And thank you to your audience for listening. Thank you.